What was it like to hear about the JFK assassination? Or America's triumph over Hitler? We're seeing Queen at Live Aid. Our past is a collection of stories that bring us to now. Welcome to the Eyewitness History Podcast, where we view history through the eyes of the people that watch the events that shaped our world. Here's your host, Josh Cohen, and these are their stories.
Hello, everyone, and thank you for tuning into this episode of Eyewitness History. I'm, of course, your host, Josh Cohen. This episode, I speak with Jackie Constam. Jackie Constam grew up in North London, where she still lives. She studied in an ancient Jewish community in France for her PhD, never guessing how the skills acquired then would later help her delve into her own family story. Jackie has written a book called The Memory Keeper, A Journey into the Holocaust to Find My Family. Jackie's mother rarely talked about what happened during the war and kept little evidence of her early life. Jackie knew that her mother had managed to get out of Berlin in 1936, following her brother and sister who had already left, but that her grandparents had remained in Germany. All further details were shrouded in the mists of history, with Jackie's childhood a constant battle to avoid upsetting her mother with questions or reminders. And then, one night, sometime after her mother's death, Jackie Googled her parents' names on a whim. Where previous searches had come up blank, this time she had a surprise. Only 4 days earlier, two Stolperstein, also known as stumblestones, had been laid outside the house in Berlin where they once lived. Someone, a stranger, had commissioned this memorial to her grandparents, each listing their name, year of birth, the date of deportation, and the date of their murder by the Nazis. Jackie discusses all of this in her book, once again called The Memory Keeper, which we discuss at length. It was a real pleasure, lots of very interesting history, and I hope you enjoy. And now I give you Jackie Constam. Okay, I'm here with Jackie Constam. Jackie, thanks for coming on the podcast.
You're welcome. Nice to be here.
Oh, it's my pleasure. I'm happy to have you, Jackie. I'm excited to discuss your book, The Memory Keeper, your grandparents, your story as well. Before we do, Jackie, please tell our listeners briefly who you are and what you do.
Well, my main, I'm not in my first flush of youth, so my main career is teaching, which is what I did. And I trained as a historian, which is actually quite interesting because early on, I did a doctorate in, I reconstructed an old Jewish community in southern France. And I never knew I was going to find out about my own family. But a lot of the methods that I did then stood me in good stead for what I would do later. I just had no idea. So that is one thing. And then I went into teaching, academic and also more practical teaching, began writing, you know, and did the two things concurrently. I mean, I had the proper job and then I wrote some plays and stories and articles, and I've always done that. And then taught different groups as well. People were isolated, people with different abilities, which I enjoyed very much. And then I fell upon what you're, you know, interviewing me about, this information about these memorials that were done to my grandparents. And that kind of, I suppose, hurried along my retirement from the proper job. And then I thought, right, I'm going to spend my time doing this. This is important.
Yeah, without question. Thank you, Jackie. I appreciate it. You mentioned it. So now I'm just really curious to ask you, when you say that you reconstructed a Jewish community, what exactly does that mean? Can you talk about that for a minute?
Oh, okay, yeah. Well, it was in southern France. I don't want to go on and on about it. I could do, but we're not here for that.
Right.
There was, very briefly, before the French Revolution, that area around Avignon, east of Avignon, was a papal state. It belonged to the popes, had done for a long time. And as you may know, that Jewish, they were in ghettos, Jews, but they were protected. I mean, they had to pay for there to exist, but they were protected. And quite a lot was known about a couple of the bigger communities. There were four of them. And one of them had completely disappeared. I mean, physically, you know, nothing remained. There was no synagogue. There's a little synagogue in Kappenplatz, for example, a very pretty 18th century synagogue, and in another little town. But from the written records, I found who was who, and you know, marriage contracts, wills, and so on, worked through it, and found all sorts of ways they lived their life. And I worked also to some collaboration with a local historian, and we published some stuff together. And it was fascinating. You saw who married who, had great arguments with whom. I've always liked a story. For me, history, the story is the interesting thing of the history. And, you know, and showing how families lived together and, yeah, it, and they had some strange customs because they lived there a long time, which Jewish communities didn't do. So, you know, we wrote about that a bit as well. Anyway, that's it in what I did. And the town, any of you, your listeners, I ever go to France, it's absolutely beautiful. It's a little town called L'Île-sur-la-Sorgue, which is literally an island on the River Sorgue, and a lot of water flowing through it. It's about, I don't know, about 15 miles or so east of Avignon. It's very pretty, worth visiting.
Yeah, excellent. Wow, that's fascinating. Thank you, Jackie. The reason you caught me smiling a minute ago is I completely agree with you. All history is just a collection of stories. And that's sort of the theme that I try and push out, you know, by doing interviews like this. So I agree with you. So yeah, moving right along, I just chomping at the bit to ask you, what was it that prompted you to write The Memory Keeper?
It was, well, it's been a very long journey because I always wanted to know about my mother's family. And it was difficult. I knew quite a lot about her early childhood in Berlin, and we had old photos of her parents and the wider family, but so many of them had been murdered by the Nazis that, you know, she didn't, it was a very difficult area to approach and to discuss with her. So, and as I grew older, I found out more and more. I started reading about it and so on and so forth, but she hadn't kept anything. And gradually, as I got older, I inherited or found stuff that my aunt and uncle, her older siblings, had kept. And because I'm an only child and they had no children themselves, all this paperwork came to me. But I didn't quite know what to do with it, and I couldn't read it. And then suddenly, for no particular reason, once many years on, further on when that generation had all gone, I just Googled my mother's maiden name one night on the way to bed, and my grandparents popped up on the screen. And someone, I didn't know whom, had put these memorials. They're called Stolpersteine in German. They're little brass-covered blocks that are set in the pavement outside the front door of where the people who'd been murdered used to live. So it is quite effective, really, because you know that they walked past that door, went in and out, and so on. And someone had done that for my grandparents. And so there was a contact number, and I rang them up the next day and gave these people a tremendous shock because they'd only just done it. They'd only done it a few days earlier, which was kind of strange. And so I felt I needed to go to Berlin and meet them, which I did. And having always been alone with this history, really, of my mother's, and understandably, you know, that generation found it quite difficult to talk about. It took a long time before people began to open up, if you like. Survivors is very much so. My parents were refugees in the UK. And so it was kind of a revelation that somebody in Germany, a total stranger, had done that for my grandparents. So that was really a lovely feeling that I wasn't alone with this legacy anymore. You know, other people wanted to know about them. And then just one thing led to another. So I did lots of trips to Berlin and just thought, I've got to find out more about this and write about this. But I didn't yet quite know what form it would take. It took a while to develop.
Yeah, absolutely, Jackie. I'm very curious about, you perhaps gleaned at it in your last answer, but I'd love to perhaps dig a little bit further with you, what the research process was like for the book. What kind of sources did you go to unearth this information?
Well, first of all, I had my own private sources, a lot of which I found really difficult to, or quite impossible actually, to get into. Because, for example, there was a cache of letters that, after my uncle died, he lived in, all the siblings lived in different countries. So this complicated matters. So my uncle was the eldest child of my grandparents, and he lived in Israel. My aunt was the next one who lived in New York, and there was my mum in London. And, you know, I grew up in London. And so my uncle was the first one of the three to die, and he was a hoarder. He threw nothing away. So, I mean, there was just everything. And there was a folder of letters from my grandparents. I could read the signatures and I could read the dates. And I knew that most of them were written in 1938, 39, when they were trying and failing to leave Berlin and come to then what was then Palestine to my uncle would have been the easiest route, but it just didn't work out in the end. But I couldn't read the letters because they're in the old German script. I do read German, but sort of normal, you know, script. But I did learn to do it. And that was part of the writing process. That was part of the research process, was actually getting under my grandparents' skin through understanding their letters. You know, we live in an age now of emails and texts and all the rest of it. You don't have that. You know, there's a personality that comes through handwriting, and it comes through phrasing as well. You know, how you actually form a sentence. You can tell an awful lot. And so I was borrowing away in that once I learned to read it. And the other thing, and my aunt was different. She had actually prepared a whole load of stuff to give me. You are the family archivist. Here you are. That's more or less what she said. And it was all her love letters and her diaries. And she had an extremely active, if I can say, love life when she was young. And, you know, and had several husbands. And she was a real character. And she was the driving force for my uncle and my mother getting out, actually. So I think they, you know, I might not have been here if it hadn't been for her. And so I had all these papers, but found it often quite overwhelming. And it's really only once I started going to Germany that it freed me up to look at all this stuff. And then I started following it up with going into the archives of Berlin and having some help there, because, I mean, it was a minefield. As you know, Germany was divided for so many years. And when I went there in the early, or mid, yes, it was around about, I started around going around 2006, 2007 were my main times for going. I went a few more times later, but those were the main ones. And Germany had come together in, you know, whatever it was, 10 more years earlier, 15 years earlier. But it took a long time for archives. A lot had been taken to Moscow, for example, from the old GDR. It took a long time for them to all filter back into Germany. And you found some stuff in one archive and some stuff in another archive. I had quite a lot of help in order to know where to go to look for stuff. So that took a bit of time. But it was, it'd be like finding bits of a jigsaw, you know, pieces of a jigsaw, and then thinking, yes, that fits in here and that fits in there. And I also contacted second cousins of mine. So the children of first cousins of my mother who'd found refuge in different countries. So there was one in Israel and one in California. And they were very helpful and gave me bits and pieces of family information that they had. So, for example, I mean, as you know, the States, USA entered the war after the attack on Pearl Harbor. So that was in December 41. So I worked out, I thought, oh, you know, maybe my cousin in America has got more information from her grandparents, because they would have been able to write letters for two more years after correspondence ceased between Britain and Germany, because, of course, the countries were at war. And so all communication, that was in the end. You just had Red Cross messages. And so I got more information, you know, so it was a question of kind of finding out information where I could. I don't know if I've answered the question.
No, that was perfect. I loved it. No, you did. Absolutely, Jackie. And actually, it puts me in mind, one question I was kind of thinking as you were talking was, I'm curious if there was a particular, what should we call it, event or happening that sprang out of your research that surprised you? Was a particular thing that happened in the past that as you researched it, you were like, huh, I didn't know that.
Oh, you not particularly surprised me. I don't. Yeah. Well, one thing that surprised me, and actually a bit saddened me a little bit, was in some of the correspondence between my aunt and my uncle. This is after the war, when they're kind of picking up the pieces again. You know, they all survived particularly my aunt had a very dangerous time and got to New York by the skin of her teeth. And when the Germans began after the war to make reparations and so on, and I knew that there were some people who didn't claim, who were reluctant to make any claims, maybe because for emotional reasons or who knows. And it turns out that my aunt and uncle were quite reluctant to do it. And I think that my mother may have been too, but she didn't actually say. I mean, they did all make claims in the end. But, you know, you can imagine it's quite an emotional journey because you have to think of all that's been lost and it's difficult to find out. And then there are arguments with the, you know, all sorts of bureaucratic arguments. So it means going it through a journey, an emotional journey, in order to do that, when so many of that generation just wanted to shut the door on this awful history and live now, you know, the future.
Nice.
Looking. So that was something, but it wasn't a particular surprise. I was trying to think if there's anything else I found that was surprising. Sorry, I'm not very helpful here, but I can't really think of anything.
No, that's no problem. I think that fault lies more with the question than the answer. So I know in the book, you sort of glean at your mom's silence about her experiences during the war. And I'm just curious what impact, not to get too sullen or introspective, but I'm just curious if that had a particular impact on your childhood.
Oh, undoubtedly. Yes, undoubtedly. I mean, I did cover some of that in the book when I'm trying to kind of disentangle the feelings that she had, you know, not wanting to talk about it, and my nosiness and always desire to find out, you know, and there was like a tension in me. I mustn't be a bad girl and ask all these questions, sort of the interest area. So there was that. And also, I think that she required quite a lot of protection. I mean, my father protected her. And I realized that you find this a lot of children who are, you know, like child carers of parents who are ill or in some way, that they take on a lot of responsibility. And I think I did too. But, you know, when you're a kid, whatever you do is normal. You don't question it. It's just what happened. But in retrospect, as an adult, yes, you know, there was a lot of me having to look after my mom, you know, and just be good and not upset her because she had certain limitations, which I'm sure was a result of all this.
Yes, certainly. Thank you, Jackie. We're chugging right along, actually. I only have a couple questions left. I'd love to know if there's a particular, what should we say, if there's a particular message that you're looking for readers to take away from the book. If they could only take away one thing from it, what would that be, do you think, Jackie?
Well, that is an interesting question, Josh, because, yeah, I think, well, one of the things is if you keep, you know, never give up digging, you do find stuff out. I mean, this is something that I've learned through doing this. You do find stuff. You have to be persistent. But what I think is really good is that and what gives me a lot of satisfaction is that, you know, the Nazi regime did everything to wipe out the Jews and annihilate them and dehumanize them and give them numbers instead of names and, you know, just wipe them off the face of the earth. And what I have tried to do and hope, you know, hope to a certain extent succeeded in the book is to restore their humanity, to see, bring my grandparents and what I call members of the shadow family, you know, or the wider family back into the world as living, breathing human beings as they once were. Because as what you think about, when you think about it, they, most of their lives were actually quite normal. You know, they lived, and for us coming after, I think the label of victim and victimhood sort of freezes them into this kind of, you know, that is their identity. And I wanted to remove that. I wanted to remove that and say, well, actually, yes, of course they were victims and they had horrible ends. But, you know, they lived normal lives. They were loving people. They were complex. They were difficult. You know, they had all the human characteristics that we all have. And that's what I wanted to bring back. And so that, I guess, is what I'd like the reader to take away.
Yeah, that's wonderfully said, Jackie. And I understand that. I think in many cases, that's sort of the great tragedy of history is that we tend to think of Holocaust victims, for instance, we tend to think of it as like a bunch of statistics, names, facts, dates, sort of these cold, emotionless things, right? Getting back to what we were talking about earlier with stories. No, they were living, breathing people with idiosyncrasies and views and ideas. And there was so much to them, you know, before those last 4 years, 5 years, whatever it was, right?
Exactly.
And I think an appreciation of that, which your book endeavors to do, and in my view does quite well, is bring them out of that cold, emotionless void and give them real life.
Yeah, that's what I wanted, because it's like saying to the Nazis, you see, you may have got rid of them physically, but you didn't totally get rid of them because here they are.
Here they are. Yes, absolutely. What was it like when you visited, I beg your forgiveness if I mispronounce it, but the first time you visited the Stolperstein Memorial?
Yeah. Well, yeah, no, that's fine. And it was kind of exciting and strange. And it's like one of the difficulties I had was actually sometimes feeling and expressing the emotion that was so kind of had been so bottled up for a long time, sort of enable it to come out. So it was very helpful going with the people who took me to see these places, like the Schobesteiner coordination office in Berlin, a woman that came to pick me up and take me to introduce me. And then we had a chat after. And it was very moving, but I had to kind of go back afterwards and just be there on my own. And there was a moment where I just, they're only little, they're sort of 10 centimeters square. And they're side by side in the pavement. And I just stood with my feet on either side of them, you know. It was as though I was enclosing their Stolpersteiner between my feet. And that felt a connection to my grandparents, which was really just felt nice, you know. And there were other moments like that as well. So, but that was how I had a moment, you know, sort of looking at them and just, I don't know that I thought any great thoughts. It was just a nice moment.
Feeling closer to history in a way that, you know, you clearly wanted. I understand that. Just out of curiosity, you know, how do you think we can best honor and remember the victims of the Holocaust?
Oh, gosh. I don't know. I mean, I think everybody has to do it in their own way. I think what suits one person doesn't necessarily suit another. I mean, and there's so many memorials now in Germany, you know, after years of silence. Loads of them. And in other places too. I mean, in the UK, you know, there are memorials, for example, to the Kinder Transport, all the children that were brought to the UK on the eve of war. And I think, you know, people like to have a place to go. I mean, there is colossal memorial to the murdered Jews of Europe in Berlin, which takes up a vast space. It doesn't have the same effect on me as it does on other people. It's sort of too vast. I kind of quite like smaller things, but this is personal. And, you know, so I don't think there is a rule about that. I certainly believe, and I suppose as a sort of ex-academic, really, and I like the keeping of papers. So there are libraries and foundations. I mean, in the States, in New York, there's the Leo Beck Institute, for example, that takes family papers. And here in the UK, there's the Wiener Holocaust Library in London. And it's really important. People deposit their, you know, all these letters and things that I've worked through. I mean, very likely, you know, will end up there. I mean, it's just important that this stuff is a resource so that when you get Holocaust deniers around, you know, you can say, well, actually, hello, you know, we've got some evidence here.
Yeah.
And because it's important to have the evidence and to keep it. So for me, that's a very important way of memorializing people.
Certainly, yes. Yeah, the deniers and the revisionists. One thing I was thinking as you were talking, so it's funny that you mentioned preferring sort of smaller spaces. So just a quick personal reminiscence. A few years back, I went to the Holocaust Museum in D.C.
Right.
Yeah, which you're undoubtedly familiar with. You know,
I've been in contact with them. They actually have some family stuff that interests me.
Oh, interesting. Yeah, well, you've no doubt noticed, you know, with my last name, I certainly am close to it, you know, in my own way. And speaking on small areas, so they had one of the cars, one of the train cars. I don't know if it was the one that went directly into Auschwitz, but in any case, went into the camp. And as you know, they would pack 200 people in these train cars. I actually stood in the middle of this train car, and I don't know if you could have gotten 20 of me in there comfortably with being able to, you know, put your arms out and do a circle. And just the feeling of that and just knowing once was in those cars, it's a haunting feeling.
Right, I'm sure. Gosh, I don't think I'd want to do that.
Well, I didn't want to, but I had something was guiding me.
Oh, well, you have to do what you have to do.
Just out of curiosity, Jackie, I'd love to know, what advice would you give to others that are interested in uncovering their family's history and heritage?
Oh, my word. Do it is what I would say. If you're interested in doing it, do it. Link up with other people. I would say to do that. I mean, you know, these days, there's so much possibility now with, I mean, my whole thing started because of Google search, you know. Years ago, I wouldn't have known anything. You can find a lot by Googling. And a lot of for example, I found that the archives hold a lot, which they put online now. So, for example, my grandparents died in Theresienstadt or Theresien, you know, in near Prague. And the Nazis made the Jewish elders of the ghetto there keep death, make death certificates. I mean, it was a way of trying to make it look as though they were having normal deaths. I mean, they weren't gassed or anything there, but they, you know, they died of starvation and God knows what, disease and so on. It's horrible. And so my grandparents' death certificates are online. You know, anybody can look them up. And so if you know, and if you go on the Yad Vashem website of the database of Holocaust victims, you can look up if you've got relatives, you know their names, you know where they came from. And people can make witness statements. And so that's how I found another cousin who I knew about, but I'd never met her, who lived in Texas, because she'd done a witness statement for her father. Her father was a first cousin of my mother's, who suffered sadly the same fate. And it had her address and details. So I got in touch with her. And then I eventually went to visit her in Houston. And it was wonderful. You know, I only saw the ones. We had some phone calls and stuff from the UK. Unfortunately, she didn't email. She was by. But sadly, she's no longer with us. But I mean, that was really nice. I mean, that was a result of doing all this. So I would just say, try and find, you know, if you know of relatives, get in touch. Try and because it is quite an emotional journey. But there are a lot of people doing it. And there are organizations. I mean, here in the UK, there's something called the Second Generation Network, which is for people of my generation, also younger, third and so on, who want to find out. And they, you know, that we're discussion groups and they get together and they give each other information. People publish books there and memoirs on this. So I would do that, make links with people, and you can find out a lot that way. You know, where to look. That's the help. If somebody gives you the key of where to start looking. And there's Jewish genealogy things. I mean, that you can also go on. I've never done that, actually. I'm not quite sure how I would do it, but I know my cousin in Israel has done that and sent me some information. So, you know, just use all these possibilities. I don't know how helpful that is. But I mean, you know, start looking because you will find stuff, particularly online.
Yeah, without question, Jackie. So yeah, the book once again is called The Memory Keeper. Where can people find a copy, Jackie?
Well, Amazon or good bookshops, but I don't know how you get it in the States. I know you're in the States. So I just know you'd have to find out, but it's called Memory Keeper and it's published by in the UK by Canongate. And Google it and see if you can get it.
I'll be sure I leave all links that I can in the show notes for this interview, Jackie. Jackie Kansam, how can people find out about you?
Well, I've always been rather backward in coming forward with things. Like I don't do social media, so I mean, I'm a hopeless case, and I don't. But there's going to be, I think if you Google me, there'll be various things that come up to do with a book now. And I'm getting some help with this. We haven't quite sorted this out because the book is imminent to be published, but it's not out quite yet, where all interesting things about it will be on a kind of like a little, I think it's called Linktree, kind of website where you can look stuff up. And we're going to put stuff on there. So that's where that you will be able to find stuff about me.
Excellent. Jackie, this was such a pleasure. I really appreciate you taking the time for me. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much for being interested. You know, I'm glad you liked the book.
I did. Excellent. Well, thank you again for the time, Jackie. I will let you go. I really appreciate it.
That's a pleasure. Nice meeting you, Josh. Okay, bye-bye.
You too, Jackie. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Thanks for listening to this episode. If you'd like to support Eyewitness History, the easiest way to do that would be to subscribe to the show on the podcast player of your choice and leave a review. For more information on Eyewitness History, along with show notes and links to resources, go to ParthenonPodcast.com, where you can also listen to some other great podcasts by the Parthenon Podcast Network, such as Scott Rank's History Unplugged, Steve Guerra's History of the Papacy, James Early's Key Battles of American History, and Richard Lim's This American President, along with many others. Thank you.
The Historical Jesus Podcast is the sweeping saga of the life and times of Galilean Jesus of Nazareth, as well as the faith, religion, and church founded to honor and disseminate his acts and teachings. Join me, Mark Vinette, on this fascinating journey through time, exploring the many great works of Christian theology, literature, architecture, music, and art inspired by the words and deeds of Jesus Christ.